So, hope you're feeling nice and settled. You can really take in and notice what a morning of practice does. So don't miss it. It goes back to that noticing the states when we're a little quieter so that the mind gets a taste for it. Yeah. So there's we've been looking a lot at non-attachment in the mind, and I wanted to look a little bit to this morning at sort of the correlation between this and the state of samadhi. You know, most of us will admit in one way or another experiencing in life a certain amount of suffering and difficulty. And so, you know, what draws us to Buddhist practice or any spiritual practice, I guess, is we're looking for a way out of that. You know, a way to deal with it, at least, if not completely overcome it. And, you know, it's almost like you want to replace a certain suffering in the mind with a certain kind of peace, you know. And that is, this is actually the state of samadhi, the capacity to be quiet and still in the presence of whatever's happening. And Buddha talks about it in many ways in the teachings, and you know, our job is to try to understand it and discover for ourselves how to cultivate it. So one of the things I've noticed, certainly in my own understanding and misunderstanding with a lot of the people that I talk to, is that it seems to get categorized or confined in its definition to a very specific and very absorbed state. You know, the Buddha does talk about this, where the mind gets so precise in its awareness of what's happening that it gets very one-pointed on a single object. And certainly if you've done Anapanasati, the mindfulness of the in and out breath, a lot of that is what that's about. Or if you've done jhana practices, or the absorbed states, that's what that's about. And I think, you know, that state of having the mind completely absorbed and fixed is definitely part of what we talk about as samadhi. In this sense, it's more synonymous with the state of jhana, or being completely absorbed in whatever's going on. So, but it's not necessarily just that. There is jhana, there is that absorption. But samadhi, when the Buddha talks about it, he talks about it in a number of ways. That's part of it. And I want to point this out at the get-go, because I think we can set ourselves up for a lot of frustration in practice if you think that, it's this kind of laser-sharp precision in observing. You think that you have to completely immerse yourself in the object to the exclusion of everything else. That's part of it. You know, that is definitely part of it. In the suttas, when the Buddha talks about insight, he often talks about first as going into these very absorbed states and then coming out of them, and that's the setup for the potential for insight. You know, his mind is so calm and so able to look with things in a very refined way that he can see things. But when you describe it that way, it doesn't feel very accessible. You know, and a lot of people suffer with frustrations because they can't actually establish that kind of one-pointedness in the mind, certainly not on a day-to-day basis, you know. Maybe some people have a propensity for that kind of absorption, and it comes quite easily. But the percentage of people who can do that is very small. That's not without its problems, too. A lot of people who have a great propensity for that kind of absorption get lost in it and get very attached to it. Like there's the way the Buddha talks about it is it's a pleasant abiding here and now. It's very delicious to be withdrawn from pain and difficulty and all the mental states that are our suffering. And so people who have a propensity for it tend to get very attached to it. You know, and I've actually noticed it that the ones that seem to have a propensity for it are not always, but often people who've had a lot of suffering in their life. and just by, before even Buddhism, they've learned how to pull out and get away. And certainly at its worst, it's more dissociative than just being absorbed. But so there's a propensity, a relationship there sometimes with being in a lot of pain and having skill at being able to withdraw from it. But the way, some of the language that the Buddha uses to describe samadhi is very interesting. One of them is, they talk, you hear this frequently throughout the suttas, that one is secluded from the hindrances. And this word seclusion, it has a very specific meaning in Buddhism, and that's really what it is. It's like, one of the images he uses that I like is, it's like a tortoise that pulls completely into its shell in order to avoid being eaten by the jackal. You know, it's like you can go completely within to avoid danger. And that's at this peak state of absorption, that's what it's like. But clearly, the teachings also talk about samadhi in a much wider sense, a broader sense. And one of the ways, for example, although it's a weaker state, it's not that kind of driven, probing, laser-like precision. It's a weaker state of relaxation, but it's one that is often talked about with sila, you know, with good conduct, keeping the precepts. That once the mind begins to discern the difference between kusala, skillful conduct, and akusala, unskillful conduct, that it begins to learn about the consequences of the unskillful and begins to naturally turn towards what is skillful, because it's a much more pleasant state. It's a much more happy state. And the state of samadhi is sometimes used in the suttas as synonymous with what we call kusala consciousness. It's a state of a wholesomeness in the mind that we're happy. I mean, and all you don't have to look very far to see this. I mean, I find that, at least just watching over the years, that a lot of the agitation, whether it's sitting in formal practice or all the chatter that's going on in the mind throughout the day, a lot of it is around harm that I've done or harm that's been done to me, you know, or apparent harm. You know, you just look and see. It's like that little, you know, if somebody barks at you, how the mind will just go on and on, and it sort of like festers or gets in these loops around harm. And it's a mind that's agitated because there's not a skillfulness either coming at us or coming up in us. Yeah? And so you begin to notice that as that skillfulness gets stronger, and that's why we talk about working with the precepts as a very important part of the whole process of waking up. That you know, you've got to get into a skillful state, or you just go on and on about it. You know, notice, you know, if you have any kind of addictive tendencies, you know, how the mind will just go on about this, and how agitating that is, you know. So this is part of it, and samadhi is the state of being settled because you've learned about goodness. You've learned about skillfulness and wholesome behaviors, and you're happy. And the mind is very happy. And so there's that, and then there's also a state of samadhi that comes with just what we've been talking about on Thursday nights, just this. It's a more pervasive, in a way, a weaker state than say the jhana absorption, but it comes from non-attachment to sense pleasures, where you know, like the bird, the sound, the smell, the flavor, that what is the experience of being present and the knowing of that sound, the knowing of it as pleasant versus the you know, the moving out and the grabbing hold and wanting it to continue or wanting more. That it's that. So you know, samadhi has a very practical and a real level of experience that just comes from learning about the difference between attachment and non-attachment, and settling in the in the state of non-attachment. And at this level, one of my teachers, one of the monks, he just goes, samadhi, pure enjoyment, a very happy state from not being entangled in things. So what we've been doing, looking at the teachings on attachment, the Upadana teachings, is just looking at how the mind seeks sense pleasures and what's going on with all of that. You know, it's a fascinating area of practice because it doesn't take much to begin to realize that it's all coming from a bias in the mind that thinks that the rule or the standard should be pleasure, stability, and control. You know, and right at the get-go, as you start to notice this, you know, that's the way it should be. It should be certain, it should be stable, it should be pleasant, I should have some semblance of control over things. That's the bit that's making the mind jump and grab and try to control in a way what our experience is. Yeah. And so, you know, the sensory experience, however, what we know from the teachings and can know from our direct knowledge is impermanent suffering and not under our control. It's uncertain, unsatisfactory. So right at the get-go, you've got this dilemma, you know, and so you have kind of a built-in conflict. And what we begin to notice as we practice is that conflict and the not seeing of that conflict is what's tying up a tremendous amount of energy. You know, we expend an enormous amount of energy longing for and resisting conditions as they are, because we don't understand impermanent suffering and non-self. You know, that's any kind of all insight is taking us to this kind of understanding, so that you hit the mother lode and you can offset or completely overcome, uproot the tendencies to make things be some way other than the way that they are. You know. And the way that they are is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not subject to our control. So, you know, all of the impulse to gratify ourselves through the senses, to cling to things, is, when you see it in this way, it's doomed at the start. It's doomed to failure. There's no way that one can come to a place of complete gratification through the sensory realm. There's just there's no way for it to happen. I mean, I laugh, but it's painful until we start to get it, you know. And for all of our efforts, no matter how much wonderful things we accumulate or get or indulge in, whatever, for all of our efforts, we always, in the end, come away unsatisfied. And that's the human dilemma. That's the dilemma that we find ourselves in. And, you know, you never really fully win the prize. So that's the bad news of what we see ourselves do. But the good news is, and this is one of the blessings of the Buddhist practice and teachings, I think, the good news is that not any ultimate happiness is not in any of that anyway. You know, it can be completely abandoned. And not only can it be, but the experience of abandoning the quest for sensory pleasure and the avoidance of sensory pain, that whole thing, once it's dropped, then actually puts us in the place where we wanted to be in the first place, which is just here and content with things as they are. And that's, you know, you just feel that. I mean, that as the heart touches these realities, and this is what we're doing through meditation practice, it just relaxes. It just lets go of this endless quest. And this relaxation is what we call samadhi, this capacity to be at peace with the ultimate reality of the way that things are. So how do we enjoy this kind of peace? Is really just the first step is just letting go. The first step in the experience of samadhi is cultivating this non-attachment. So that's why I've been focusing on it so much. And we do with this primarily through the four foundations of mindfulness. You know, it's all predicated on these practices that we've taken up. And again, the invitation that's laid out in that instruction is to be aware of what is going on with the body and the mind. So be aware of sensations, the sights, the sounds, the smells, the tastes, the touches. And be aware of the feelings, the experiences of pleasure and pain and neither. Be aware of the thoughts that come into the mind. And train the mind. It's a training. Bhavana is mental development. But train the mind to leave it at that. To know that your experience, our experience at that level, and to leave it at that. And what I find interesting through the years is that we don't even have to know where, for many years, you don't really even have to know where the practice is leading. You just have to follow the directions. So when the Buddha says, pay attention to sensation, feeling, and thought, and leave it at that, that's a huge, that takes some unpacking. You know, that's easier said than done, isn't it? And so the process of learning how to do that is the process of seeing what we keep grabbing and the consequences of the grabbing, and through that direct knowledge, just beginning to let that go. But you don't have to know that. At least that's been my experience. You don't really have to know that's what's happening for it to be effective. And I say this because, you know, I mean it as a support. If there's confusion in the mind, and, you know, you're practicing, and every now and then you go, oh, what am I doing? You know, and why? But that's really a very common experience. And, you know, we need to talk about this, you know. We need to get that on the table so that people know that this is not unusual. This is normal, you know. I mean, when I first went to retreat, I did a very long retreat, not just months, but years. And if I'm honest, you know, many months into that, I could be doing my little walking meditation or sitting on the cushion or whatever, and then sometimes I would just stop dead in my tracks and go, no, wait a minute, what am I doing? You know, and like, I don't remember. You know, you just sort of kind of get in a groove and try to do it and don't really know yet. The feedback loop as to what it is, what it's doing, and what it's affecting, it just takes some time, you know. And as you get that feedback loop going, then it becomes more clear. Oh, that's how it's affecting me. That's how it's affecting change. So you know, I say this by way of just as a reminder: when we're caught in that, don't get caught in doubt and confusion. We're completely reorienting the mind, and there's going to be times when you're just not going to know. And that's okay. Just take a deep breath, relax, and know that we're in a process of bringing about some understanding here. You know, we're trying to discover what it means just to let things be. And so many times in that process, you may not know or understand, and that's okay. And another thing, just, you know, honestly speaking, you know, sometimes it can be frustrating, and for many occasions where you don't, in those moments of not understanding, that, you know, you just want to scream out or holler. I mean, I did it a number of times in this long retreat where I would, you know, they would say, well, just like a big one for me was be with the pain. You know, just be with the pain. And I would just go, I don't know what you mean. It was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Because the sensation as pain and as something to be hated was all one thing. You know? And what the practice is doing is sort of separating out different aspects of any moment's experience, you know? And it just, as you're trying to sort that out, it can be very frustrating. You know, I remember screaming at one of the teachers one time, you be with the pain. I don't know what you're talking about. I can't do this, you know. Very, very difficult at times. But then I recover and just try to do it. Just try to say, try to be with the pain and see if I can sort out what that even means. You know, and there was a tremendous amount of faith and trust in the Buddha at this time. It was like all I could do at some times was just go, man, I hope he's right. You know, because I'm putting in a lot of time here, and I'm really trying. But I would just trust that there's something in all this. And that is an interesting reflection in itself right there. If you've ever gotten to that moment, those kinds of moments, just turn around and look at that. I mean, there is a huge amount of faith driving us. And that is not, faith is not something that just suddenly appears. This is a karmic fruit. It's coming from a deep devotion and probably not a small amount of understanding, you know? And that needs to be seen and felt and acknowledged, you know, because I sometimes just marvel at how we keep showing up, how we keep coming back. It's like, you know, when I was little, I used to love to ride roller coasters, and I would stand in line, and I would be terrified about what was about to happen. And I forget, it was this park near me, it was a quarter to ride the thing. And as you get closer and closer and closer, you know, and then you go on the ride and you scream your bloody lungs out the whole time, you know, and then it comes around and you reach in your pocket and give the guy another quarter. I want to do it again, you know. And I see meditation as a lot like that. And faith is driving that, you know. It's like there's something in it, as hard as it is. You get your schedule book out and you plan another retreat. You plan another discussion group. You plan another book read. I mean, it's amazing. Notice that this is some significant stuff arising in this heart that is drawn, and at some level that may not even be fully conscious, there's a resonance and there's a knowing. That there's this is a path that will take you to freedom, and so use it. You know. So one of the things that we notice is that for a long time, and this can be many years in practice, if not all of practice, a lot of what's going on is that you notice that you're caught up, and you let go. You notice that you're caught up, and you let go. Yeah, you notice that you're caught up, and you let go. And this watch this quality. I mean, some people often report that's all they're doing, and this is very good. This is really good practice to see that understanding, to know to release is there, to know to let go. But also pay attention to the quality of the heart and the mind in those moments when you find out that you're caught up and you let go. Because I promise you, this is one of the good measures of how your practice is progressing, how you're maturing in it, is that over the years, that letting go will become more and more sort of just no big deal. You know, it's like it because it's getting more and more informed. Initially, it's got, and then over the years, it's just a letting go. You know, I mean, I noticed that it's almost like what begins to build is a force field around attachment and the impulse to attach, and it's almost like you can't do it after a while, or you haven't caught up, you let go more easily. And so, like that's a very important thing to notice, I think, because it'll build confidence in. It's a fruit of practice, and it builds confidence to begin to realize that the letting go is happening more easily, the getting caught up is happening less frequently. This kind of thing. So really, if this is the bulk of practice, is seeing that you're caught up and letting go. Your practice is going very well. You know, that's how it's all happening. And the only thing that you could bring to bear on that could improve it, is a heightened awareness of that moment with as much equanimity as you can muster. Yeah, that's where so much of the action is. Now, but you do want to be on the lookout for that exasperated... You know, the bit that gets so irritated when we find that we've been caught up. I call it kicking myself when I'm down, you know. I'm already in pain. And this critical thing in my mind, you know, bad girl, you know, look what you did, that kind of thing. So just helpful to... pay attention to that, and a couple of things. Just seeing it will help to see the pain of doing it, so it'll get weaker over time. You know that it the mind, the unawakened mind, thinks it's helping, you know? But it has to be seen that it's not helping at all. It's just actually digging the groove deeper, you know. So it's kind of pointless. And one of the things that I've learned, and this has been a key part in my own practice, is that to not be critical of the, you know, because then you get this thing going where it's like you're judging the state that you're in, then judging the fact that you're judging, you know. And it's just the mind, the unawakened mind is doing the best it can. It's trying to get us out of the pain we're in, but it's just going about it in all the wrong ways. So one of the things that I found really helpful is to listen to the voice of the exasperated voice a little bit, but with a very open heart, because that is the voice of the pain that we're in. You know, if you don't get pissed off that you're being pissed off, then you hear it's like, I'm doing it again. You know, it comes out like that. At least to me it does. You know, but it's like it's a moaning and a groaning with the pain. And if you can hold it as the voice of the pain that you're in, then exasperation turns to compassion. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh. You know, what follows on the heels of that, if you really listen, there's somebody else going, we go, oh, poor baby, come here, let me hold you, let me make you feel better, you know. But we don't do it to ourselves. And so, like, do that instead when there's that exasperated, frustrated voice, because we're still getting caught, you know. Oh, you're suffering. And hold it like that, and feel that, you know. This is actually a sign that the non-attachment is growing. And in that moment, there's a lot of samadhi. It's actually, you can be right in the midst of some very difficult thing, and there's a lot of samadhi, you know, because we're holding it properly. So, you know, this is the ways that working with the foundations of mindfulness is affecting the kind of change that we're going for. And Actually, it's also how the overcoming of self-view takes place. You know, most of us think that, I think if we're honest with, think that this idea of no self or non-self, this idea of overcoming the sense of self, is going to come in some kind of a lightning flash or, you know, some kind of, I know I did for a long time, I thought it was, something was going to happen. And it was all going to be broken up and dispelled somehow. You know, and I had some, you know, Christian ideas in there. There's just that Paul on the road to Damascus kind of thing, you know. It was just going to be that, yeah, that kind of flash. That's not to say it doesn't, can't happen that way, but it's not, I haven't seen it like that so much. It's more the case that the overcoming of self is something that is kind of like a drift. The mind just stops grabbing hold of everything that it comes into contact with, or it does it less and less and less. And that is actually, you know, to demystify the eradication of self-view. That's what self-view is. It's the picking up of sensation, feeling, and thought from the vantage point of me. That's a view to what's happening from the vantage point of me, and it gets clung to, right? And so if you're working with the four foundations of mindfulness and relinquishing that tendency to grab, then this is the exact same process that eradicates self-view. It is in itself the overcoming of self-view. So little by little, we get more and more relaxed and impartial in relation to what we're experiencing. So one time I was watching it, and I was just looking at this tendency to get caught in self-view and repeatedly reacting to what's going on in my mind, in my body, just that tendency right there. And I suddenly saw it was like having someone inside you, you know, who's always talking and always chattering away about what's going on, you know, and always commenting. I saw it one time as kind of like a commentator in a golf match, you know. She's stepping up to the ball. She's addressing the ball. You know, it's like this constant comment. It's like my constant commentee. You know, this constant comment about what's going on. And then, you know, if it gets frightened around that, then making it a problem, and then getting tangled up in all kinds of thoughts and ideas about how to address the problem, you know. And you start to unpack that, and you could see how we're the suffering is all this quote unquote self-created. It's all happening out of a way of relating to things from that vantage point of self. So, you know, working with the four foundations of mindfulness, it's kind of like, at least for me, as I was working with this image I was having, it was kind of like learning to just be with the chatter, but not particularly listen to it, you know, except at key times, maybe when it's the voice of the pain or something like that. But just noticing that the mind is habituated to relating in that way. Just noticing that. And letting it do it. And so one of the big mistakes that you can do in practice is to try to make that stop. Because it just engages us in a tangle with it. You know, it's like a battle. And we don't have to make it stop. We just have to learn to relate to it differently. And in a way, outlive it, you know. Just let it chatter away and learn to turn a blind eye, if you will, or just to notice it as that's something the mind does. Where it's coming from, actually, is this. It's kind of an evolutionary capacity of the human mind that it can look at itself, and it's very. You add to that the fact that we're very verbal, articulate, and what we're actually witnessing is just the mind articulating to itself what's happening all the time. That's all that's going on. It's seen in that way. There's nothing to worry about. There's nothing. You don't have to believe it. You don't have to go with it. It's just reflecting. It's like a looking at itself in a mirror. That's all it's doing. And you can buy into it if you want. But a lot of that, if not all of it, is our suffering. So in the meantime, while we're trying to learn to relate skillfully, or we're trying to see that, I've just picked up a couple of strategies that really help me with it. So when the mind is just chattering away or giving me its opinion all the time, about what it thinks I should do or shouldn't do, I sort of developed this kind of Elvis Presley voice inside my mind, and there's like, oh, thank you very much. I just kind of hold it with a little bit of thing. I appreciate it, I just laugh a little bit and get outside of it. Or if it gets really bad, then just shut up already, You're driving me nuts. Can't you quiet down? And it does respond to that kind of command or request, It's just often gets completely out of control. And that we're trying to get to a place of samadhi in the presence of it, but also a state of samadhi that is secluded from it. Initially, it's just the best you can do is just to find some stillness in the presence of it. But as it develops, then the mind can actually get quiet. It actually feels good sometimes, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So don't believe me. Just the idea is to look and see in our experience, and I would just ask that, don't you find as the years go by that even if you're still awash in delusion, right, which we probably are a bit, that you're getting freer of the habits of the mind. You're getting freer of the judgments that it keeps throwing up. And some of you might be sitting there saying, well, no, I don't think I did, But if that's the case, I would say you're not looking close enough. You're not, because this practice is efficacious. It is freeing us. And sometimes, I actually met a guy one time that had such an attitude of mind, a half-empty kind of attitude of mind, that that perception or that way of looking at things was obstructing his capacity to see that he actually was getting better. Somebody I worked with over years, there was no question that he was improving from practice, but no. But no, you're not seeing it. Develop the habit of seeing it. So that's like what's going on with the working with the foundations of mindfulness, and how the non-attachment is bringing us to a place of a stiller, a quieter mind, a mind that's more secluded from the hindrances. Well, you can come at it in another way, which is to actively identify and cultivate the experience of samadhi. We need samadhi. We need this stillness. Otherwise, you just keep getting pulled in. It has a very grounding and stabilizing effect, so that the no matter how forceful and strong the habit is, you've got some stability in the presence of it. That's what we're trying to cultivate. So right at the beginning of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, it says, having put away covetousness and grief for the world, one relaxes and abides in the breathing. And that right there is the description of samadhi. Having put away covetousness, the longing and the resistance, greed and hatred, having put away these two pendulum swings that are so much our standard way of being with things. So he's pointing to samadhi right there. Now, you know, when you think about it, to say that at the beginning of the sutta, it can be like, well, you know, wait a minute, I thought the practice was supposed to get us to that. And you're telling me I got to be there first before, you know, it's kind of a catch-22. But at least the commentaries say that he's actually pointing to a subsiding of that state, that sort of being moderately secluded from the hindrances. Because and that the way Ajahn Chah put it is that you don't need a whole lot of this samadhi to get going. You just need enough to establish some semblance of presence of mind. And I like that, the way he puts it, you know, some semblance of presence of mind. So that's what I think the Buddha's pointing at, having put him away covetousness and grief for the world. Just offsetting a little bit the impulse to grab. So cultivating it, what we're trying to do is just, at least the way we're offering it, trying to understand it now, is just really, really learning to relax. And I know I say this a lot, but we need to repeat it a lot. You know, for myself, I actually had to pick up that as a mantra in a way for a period of time. This was quite a number of years ago, but it sort of came on the heels of some of the bad news of practice, which is that as you become more awake, become more able to see what's going on, then you see what's going on. And for myself, I realized that I had a very nervous temperament, very anxious a lot of the time, fearful, worried, that those kinds of states seemed to be my dominant mode. And, you know, probably for most of us, I think if we sort of go back and forth between dominant mode of restlessness and agitation and sloth and torpor, you know, just a constant ricochet between these states. But for me, it was a rude awakening. I had no idea. I had so much anxiety. I was so afraid. I was afraid of my own shadow, that kind of thing. So for a long period of time, I still do sometimes, just running a mantra, you know, relax, relax. And the voice would get softer and softer and more loving and more kind as the time went by. Because it wasn't an indictment. It was an invitation, you know. that kind of feeling. Just relax. And I also discovered at that time that the great help that water was for me, you know, getting in a bathtub or getting in a pool or ocean, or a body of water, preferably warm water. And probably with lots of bubbles. But there was a period there where I would take hot baths 2 or 3 times a day. You know, just because I was so aware of that anxiety and the effect that this warm, the fire element and the water element had on it, you know. And really, really soothed me. It just made that just became a priority. And it was very, very helpful, because what got cultivated in that was not only the physical release of that tightening, but also just the generation of kind, compassionate states towards the pain that I was in, towards myself and the pain that I was in. And so similarly, in the cultivation of samadhi, I know I've mentioned these a couple of times already, but two things that are very, very helpful is paying attention immediately when you wake up in the morning, just really getting in the being in the body and not getting up until you're relaxed and embodied. And be careful, because the mind's a bit of a weasel. It'll use that as, oh, I'm not relaxed yet, you know. You just stay in bed a little longer, you know. But you know what I mean. Just if we start the day not in that compulsion, not in that driven state or grabbing state, then this is very helpful. And the other thing that I do frequently is a very long inhale and exhale. So, and this is what I love about that is it's very portable. It's a very portable strategy or technique. No matter where you are, no matter what's going on, if you're caught in a agitated state, nobody even has to know you're doing it. It just comes out as a sigh almost, and that's normal. Everybody sighs. You know, you take a real, real long, slow inhale, and a really long, slow exhale. And what that does, it can completely shift the inner terrain of the mind, because we begin to see that inhale is kind of like a totally 100% accepting and receiving the condition that is you're experiencing, yeah, and then letting go of any part of us that has a quarrel with that. That's movement of rising. It's also the rising of mindfulness and the relaxing into samadhi. You can look at that movement and see how many things are going on in that, and how incredibly helpful it is. And there was a book a number of years ago that was going around the monasteries by one of the monks who's in Australia, I think. Anyway, he wrote this book called A Swift Pair of Messengers. It's about Vipassana and Samatha. And it's the first time I heard this. It may be more common in different literature, but I had never heard it before. But he kept referring to samadhi as emotional development. Mm-hmm. It was interesting. He said it was the capacity to rest in an emotionally soothing place with whatever is happening. That somehow spoke to me. So I'll offer that in case it speaks to you as well. It's like, oh, it's okay. There's an okayness and an emotionally accepting and soothing place with it. So just looking at this idea of samadhi as this, not so much this absorbed state of mind, but this softer, pervasive way of being relaxed in the presence of things. It can go against the grain of some of the things that we've learned in various meditation retreats or through various instructions. And so just to know that, I think the distinction that the mind needs to understand is that these very absorbed states of jhana are one thing, and samadhi is not outside of that. That's included in our definition of samadhi, but it includes a lot of other variations on the theme, if you will. So that we loosen this idea of this driven one-pointedness. I don't want to throw it out, obviously, because you'll find in this relaxed state, then you come right back to that. The more relaxed you are, the more you're looking at one thing at a time and doing it in a very one-pointed way. So I don't think we're talking about two different things. We're actually talking about the same thing. So this letting go and letting be, just the quality of finding peace in the presence of things, it needs to be noticed in and of itself. It's a very happy experience. And so it's good in and of itself. We're less caught up with sensory experience, less preoccupied with the objects of the mind, quieter internally through the experience of samadhi, less caught up from a vantage point of self-view, all these things I've been talking about. And all of that sort of culminates in a capacity to scrutinize what's going on. And this is where the insight comes in. This is where the capacity for insight is born. It's coming out of this capacity to just stand back and notice what's happening. So, I think I've mentioned this before, but one of the things that I find really interesting is to recognize that this paradox in non-attachment. And it goes back to the question about titillating, you know, that there's by not attaching to the objects that are arising in our experience, the experience of sensation, feeling and thought, what we're relinquishing is the tendency to relate to that in some way that constitutes suffering. If you relinquish that, then what you're actually left with is the direct experience of what it is that's happening. So the paradox, I think, of non-attachment is that to the extent that you are not attached, you are very in experience. And the Buddha keeps talking repeatedly about direct knowledge. Knowledge that is derived out of being in your experience without having something, without taking exception to it, without quarreling with it or wishing it was some other way. And that takes getting all the muck out of the way. You know, that's the process of not learning to live without attachment. And then what we're left with is the experience of being a human being, but without the view to that from the vantage point of me. And that's a very direct experience. It's very direct knowledge. So you're much more in it, with it, however you want to say it. The feeling is, I'm here, and I know I'm here. It's kind of they talk about this as a sort of the champion or the battle cry of the Arhants. You know, it's a done is what had to be done. Something like I'm here, and I know I'm here. That's basically what we're saying, what we're pointing to. So just one last thought, and we'll leave some time for discussion here. The insight that all of this is setting us up for is to just see how craving, how the lack of samadhi, how the experience of self-view are all being born out of things, not being with things as they actually are, and not knowing the reality of impermanent suffering and non-self. It's all happening out of a lack of insight. So this is why the Buddha is putting so much emphasis on positioning us so that insight can take place. And if you don't believe it, then we just invite to question, particularly with the five hindrances, what's going on with those? And just ask yourself when you're caught in any of the five hindrances. Ask yourself, why am I clinging? Why am I caught up in wanting something that I don't have? Yeah, that first one, that's the first hindrance. Why am I caught up in that? And you'll see over the months and years of practice, in one way or another, the mind is not open to or is not seeing the suffering nature of being caught up, the fact that it doesn't ultimately deliver. And it's not seeing the impermanent nature of whatever's going on. It's like if I grab hold, it won't go away. Well, good luck. You know, its nature is to rise and pass away. Why do we hate? What's going on in the experience of hatred? You know, inevitably, 9 times out of 10, there is something unpleasant that we don't want to be happening. The mind is not getting it that unpleasantness is part of life. I just felt this little chew going on in my chest. It's like, to the extent that we get it, that dukkha is part of life, then when things are unpleasant, it's normal. It's all of a sudden it falls into the realm of normal. And so the kerfuffle, the ruckus, doesn't start in relation to that in the mind. You know, why do we have sloth and torpor? Look and see what's happening when that state is in the mind. There's so many ways to describe it, but the dominant feature of this is we don't want to be with things as they are. But it's going to hurt, or, oh, but, you know, why bother? It's going to be over in no time at all, you know. Or, you know, I can't manage it, I can't control it anyway, you know. But look, it's all in there. That's what's hidden. Anxiety. The anxiety that we feel so much of the time, the restlessness and worry, what's going on with that? You know, the mind does not understand all of these impermanent suffering and non-self. It's struggling and fighting and resisting the conditioned nature of things. And doubt is a biggie. Doubt is a biggie, I think. And, you know, what's going on with this is we haven't seen how much we want to be on top of things, how much we want to be in control. And we haven't made peace with not knowing. You know, people often think that doubt is the state of not knowing, but doubt is the state of irritation with not knowing. It's not at peace with the reality that things are uncertain. You know, and our experience as human beings is one from the time that we're born till the time that we die, just being very vulnerable and in a way very helpless in the face of those realities of impermanent suffering and stuff. There's nothing to be done about that. But watch the mind go bonkers as it begins to see this. As it squirms. Or even as it doesn't see it. That's what all the squirming is about. Is trying to get away from this. And so practice what the Buddha is saying to me in no uncertain terms is touch this. Open the heart to these realities. And if it feels overwhelming, stay and be overwhelmed. You know, just keep turning towards it instead of away from it. And begin to see for ourselves that self-view is actually something that the mind has constructed to not face those realities. You know, it's actually self-view is a defense mechanism. It's a way of deflecting the attention from the simple, basic realities that we find ourselves in. It's fascinating. It's such a brilliant teaching, and so and not difficult to see. Once we understand what the Buddha is saying here, so sooner or later, as the years of practice progress, we're just one of the measures is you stop the struggle. And the mind, just you know, like that image that the Buddha uses of the monkey, you know, tied to a stake. You know, it eventually it gives up. It stops trying to run off. It stops trying to make things be some other way, and in a way, I mean, I feel it more and more through the years as kind of like a resounding yes to life on its terms. You know, we're trying to greet this experience that we find ourselves in. We got born, you know, we're human beings. We got born. These are the terms and conditions of that existence. It's like, but then, oh, okay. Oh, I get it. Yeah? On this continuum. So let's see if you have some thoughts of your own or comments. Yeah, please.
In turning towards the dukkha, mm-hmm. which I have found to be very difficult to do. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot. Intention, mm-hmm. courage, persistence, a lot of things. But when you turn towards it and it's like there, and it's like, I call it gross tooth, mm-hmm. is there a point where, I mean, how long to be with it?
Well, fortunately, you have impermanence. nothing lasts very long. And if it's lasting a long time, you're clinging to it in some way or another. It's not to say that it doesn't keep coming back. Like if it's, you know, loss of a loved one, it just keeps coming back and wanting to be felt. But to the extent that you return to it and just fully receive it, then it moves, it rises, it passes, and I don't know. Look and see. I mean, I've noticed that every wave is only about 2 or 3 seconds.
So it's the fear.
It's the fear
that it won't pass away.
Yeah.
That's when I want to distract myself.
Yeah. Or the story that's been created around it, or the woe is me kind of stuff, and. Look and see that's where all the suffering is, the compounded suffering. You know, the Four Noble Truths is not freedom from pain. It's freedom from the compounded suffering that's been created in relation to the pain. So you know, you just ride the waves of the pain. Yeah. And you know how that. That's just really true. I mean, this one book I read years ago, I love this image, which is this guy who is really into, who's a master chef, and incredibly skilled at presentation. So people would be served up the food that he would serve at his restaurant. They didn't want to eat it. It was so gorgeous. You know, it's just beautiful. It's this real master. And somebody, the way it was presented, is somebody who's totally in their niche. You know, they found their mode of self-expression, and they're just doing it. And it was very attractive, very popular place. And then one night, he heard the fire sirens, and looked out and realized it was his restaurant that was burning. You know, burning, and it burned to the ground. And the way it was described was so beautiful. He stood there on the sidewalk and he let out this blood-curdling wail and raised his hands to the skies and then fell down to his knees and sobbed and then got up and walked away. And I don't know, that image just stuck with me because it seems to me that as a metaphor, literally, that's what we need to do. It says that things fester and wallow and keep coming back up because they haven't been received in that way. Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes. I have my usual question about political activism and trying to integrate these teachings with like having a mission to accomplish, you know, getting the Water Authority to do certain things.
That's right.
So I'm just, the relaxing and letting go doesn't fit when, you know, there's this mission and there's specific things that I want to win.
Right. So you have to let go of the mission and let go of the wanting to win and trust it as a process. We think that that's what the Buddha is saying is just stop trying. That's not what he's saying. He's saying stop right there at the pain you feel at what the Water Authority is doing and the harm that it's causing. And completely receive that. Don't go past that. Because one of the things that initiates, whether it's political activism or any kind of doing something about something, is the mind is trying to deflect the attention from the pain. And a lot of crusades and causes and things like that is that. I mean, that might not be so pleasant to hear, but it's important to see that a lot of what's driving us is actually a lack of insight into dukkha. The interesting piece in this, I was telling somebody this recently, is that people who are moved to political activism, I think, hands down, pretty much across the board, they know the pain in ways that a lot of us don't. And they would be wise to turn to that pain, because you've got a leg up. You can, if you can feel that pain, then your capacity to respond to it will be improved. But don't deflect the attention into political action before you felt the pain. Keep going back to that. I don't know if you guys agree. That's all I think he's saying. He's like, he's not saying don't act, but don't act before you've done this. That's all. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And like I said, I think you, if it hurts that much and you're motivated to free people from pain, then you've got a leg up on insight into dukkha. Just go there.
Yeah, I haven't really experienced it as pain. It's more of a prevention. It's like I want to prevent a million people from getting poisoned. So
that's right.
It's like it seems very clinical and
right. But get it down to the heart. Get it out of the head. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, and you have to be careful with this, but ultimately, you can't stop dukkha. There will always be dukkha. You watch the mind want that not to be true. Mm-hmm. And we wear ourselves out trying to make it not be that way.
You mentioned relaxed. Do you mean non-attached when you say relaxed, or are they different? Maybe the relaxed leads to non-attached? Or?
Yeah, I think they're kind of... remember what I was saying one time, I think it was this one, how Ajahn Chah said, don't separate mindfulness and concentration. Mm-hmm. That they're aspects of a single experience. Mm-hmm. I think it's like that.
Okay.
Yeah, like the relaxed state is not attached. Mm-hmm. The not attached state is relaxed. Mm-hmm. Come in on any door you need to get a sense of it.
Yeah, put in concentrated possibly in there as well.
Yeah, thank you.
I relate very much to your need to relax, because this morning I even write the word relax on a piece of paper. And I kept thinking, why is it so hard to relax? And I got that it's because I have such an obsession with time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said to myself, I have all the time in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I'm dealing with a now is infinite.
Mm-hmm.
There's no beginning or end to
mm-hmm.
now. So if I buy into the now, there is no time pressure.
Mm-hmm.
If I do it, you know, mm-hmm. with responsibility, you know, then I can let go and relax.
Yeah.
But it's my obsession with time that's getting in my way.
That's right. And it's a fabrication. There isn't any time.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. There isn't any tomorrow or yesterday. It just feels that way.
Yeah, it just...
Yeah. You know what? It was a good one. I went to a Shaker community up by Barre, Massachusetts one time, and they have this sign in their workshop there that said it really captures, I think, what you're talking about. It says, "Work as if you have all the time in the world, and as if it's the last thing you'll ever do." If that isn't mindfulness and concentration, I don't know what is. Right there. We got goosebumps. So, Thank you for a lovely morning together. And I hope that, anyway, the idea is that we can stay and mm-hmm. have a little social time and enjoy our lunch together if you've brought yours and want to do that. And thank you.